Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet Online Mark, which we do every Sunday night. Don't know if there's going to be many people around tonight because of the holiday weekend. Beginning of the TechNet is where people sign in with their call letters and their name because they do have a question or a comment for the net. That for about an hour or so. That's followed by Roy AC2GS with the science talk and mailbag. And that's followed by Paul WS2N with the space report. So at this time, does anybody have any question or comment for the net? You want to sign in with your call letters and your name? A typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW listening.
N2EO with a question.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, yes.
Okay, the first guy was Rich, W2EO. You didn't give me his name. W2 Bravo Zulu, you didn't give me your name.
You see, the name is Rich also.
Okay, we got Rich and Rich. Anyone else assign with your with a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Rick, I don't know if you got it, but it was GXM, Rich.
Okay, we got GXM, Rich. What's the prefix to that? Is it W2?
Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Thank you, Dick.
Okay, we got Rich 1, Rich 2, and Rich 3. One last call. Anyone else with a question or comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, that being none, we'll start off with Rich number 1, W2N2EO, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I'm thinking it'll be a light night tonight. Not many people. I have a question. I think the other Rich, N2BZ, or whether W2BZ could probably answer it. Have an external hard drive, USB hard drive, on Windows 10. I originally had it formatted for Apple. I want to know how to reformat it for Microsoft. I got it to recognize under devices. It shows up under devices. It's drive E, but I can't get it to show up under, I don't know what you call it, when I look, I see drive C, drive D. I don't see drive E. Not there. Maybe you could turn it over to Rich Dick. I know there's a file called format.com. When I type in one, format.com, just get a flash on the screen and nothing happens. Back to net.
Okay, can anyone within the sound of my voice answer that question for Rich in 2EO? Give me your call letters right now.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Bravo Zulu, go right ahead, Rich. Number 2.
Hey, what you do is you go into control panel, you click on administrative tools, and then click on computer services. I think that's it, computer services. And then if you look down the list of what comes up, you'll see a category, disk management. Double click on disk management, wait a while, sometimes it takes a minute or so to think about it, and see if you see the drive there, which you probably will. Now, is this a USB connected drive, Rich? Go ahead.
Yes, it is, Rich, yes.
Then it should automatically come up. And what you do is, you right-click, you'll see it say whatever name it's giving the drive, and I don't know, coming from Apple, what name it would give up, but see if it's there. Then go into the little boxes to the right. One should be a big box. You may have little boxes next to it. Right-click on it, and you'll see format. And then click on format. Say you want to format it NTSC, and it'll format it for you, and either assign it a drive letter or you could assign it your own drive letter. Did you get that? Pretty simple, Rich.
I think so. I'm not really clear, but I go into control panel, administrative tools, and then what?
Administrative tools. Now, under administrative tools, if you click on that, you'll see component services, and I'm pretty sure it says, I don't have my computer on now. You know, I've only looked at it 10,000 times, but it should say computer services and component services. You don't want component services, you want computer services. Click on that, and then another list will come up, and you look down the list. Towards the bottom, you'll see disk management. Click on disk management, and you should see the drive there. If you don't see the drive, we got a problem.
Okay, I don't think we'll have a problem. Dick is amazing on Windows.
Yes.
Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, Rich, it's computer management. It's very close to that. And, yeah, you find it in the administrative tools. It'll list a whole bunch of things. You go to computer management. You click computer management. It'll open a window. Then there'll be something that says storage, and right below it's disk management. You click on that, and you can format directly from that window.
Okay, Roy and Rich, thank you very much. I'm a happy camper. Back to Ned.
Are you going to try it tonight so that you can confirm that it's working during the net? Rich, go ahead.
I probably will in a little while. Last week I fell, and I hurt my hip, so I got to move slow, but I'll probably try it in a little while.
Okay, good luck with that. That was Rich number one. Rich number two, Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. Go right ahead, Rich number two.
Rich number two. I think there's one or maybe two more Riches that frequent this particular net, which is pretty amazing. Okay, I am in condo hell, ham radio condo hell, meaning that I'm in a one-floor condo. There's nothing above me. There's no egress to the attic at all. I would have to cut out a big hole in one of the closets, and I'm only renting. I don't think they would like that too much. So I'm stuck. Now, I do own a screwdriver antenna. With that antenna and my dearly beloved Kenwood 440 SAT, I work the world, of course, under better propagation days, okay? But I am obsessed with using that screwdriver as a base to start off with, as a platform. Let me put it that way, as a platform to start off with. Let me let it drop a sec.
And do tell us where the screwdriver is mounted. Go ahead, Rich.
Mounted on a photo tripod. I don't know how to explain this, but it's clamped on to quote-unquote radios. The problem is with radios, my front lawn is a postage stamp size worth of grass, and it soon borders on both sides by other neighbors' postage-sized lawns. Okay. So, I had this idea. I've tried a lot of things with it, and I did make a couple of contacts on 20. Let me let it drop. I got a 10 over from Chicago or North Carolina or whatever. It's amazing. I would pick up the mic in the old days and get the Ukraine, you know, as easily as I'm getting North Carolina now. But anyway, I came up with the idea of when I bought the screwdriver, it did not come with the whip. And the ham radio operator who made a ton of these and they were very highly thought of, to go out and buy yourself a CB whip, about a 26-inch, 27-inch, which I did, and that's how I used it on the car. It not being on the car now, I came up with an idea of unscrewing that whip and in its place putting in an X number of feet of wire and maybe expanding the range. I know physically expanding the range. I'll let it drop again. Expanding the range of the antenna. Would that give me a quote-unquote better antenna with more tuning options? When I say more tuning options, that antenna goes into a tuner, then into the 440, which I've also mentioned a bunch of times on this net and to gracious hams like Sam and Roy and other people who've let me ask them their opinions and whatever. Dick, would that buy me anything, putting in place of the whip, a wire of any length? Go ahead.
When you do use the screwdriver, when it's not put on the automobile, what is the counterpoise? What is your ground plane for that screwdriver when it's sitting on the photographic tripod? Go ahead.
Ground plane that I've used is an approximately 40-foot piece of coax coming off the ground, wire of the antenna, and just laying flat on the ground going out into the parking lot.
And what band are you using it on, and how did you choose 40 feet, Rich Grant?
40 feet is what I bought. Well, I bought 50 feet. I needed 10 feet of it. So that's where the 40 feet comes in. It's just an arbitrary length. And I've made the two contacts on 20. With an antenna analyzer, it gets... it's a pretty hard deal to get anything under, let's say, 3.2 to 1 on 40, and 80 is nearly impossible.
Yeah, that makes some sense. When you use the screwdriver, and I'm pretty sure it's normally used in the quarter wave mode, the actual radiator is a quarter wavelength long, and a quarter wavelength radiator, which is half of a dipole, half of 73 ohms, around 37 ohms. So the base impedance is probably, let me pick a number, 35 ohms. The ground plane radials that you're supposed to be setting up, there's supposed to be enough of them of the right length so that it's a small amount of impedance compared to the 35 ohms of the base impedance of the whip that you're feeding. About 3.5 ohms would be nice. So to try to make a ground plane have 3.5 ohms of reactance, resistance, requires a very substantial ground plane. So you can see that's a difficult problem. However, if the radiator, let me drop. If the radiator was not a quarter wavelength long, but it was a half wavelength long electronically. So electronically a half wavelength long is either a much longer piece of wire and or with loading coils, zigzag, helical winding, top hat capacitor, whatever. If you can make the radiator a half wavelength long, and you're feeding it from the base. The base of a half-wave radiator could have an impedance of around 2,000 ohms. Now you'd like the ground plane to have a small impedance compared to 2,000. 200 would do it very nicely. One simple spike in the ground could easily give you an impedance of 200 ohms and be adequate. So your inadequacy of your ground plane radial system would become very adequate. It's a very simple ground plane system. Just a ground rod would do it if you made the radiator half wave long. So choosing a length of wire with loading coil so that it's electronically half wave will give you all of that benefit. You'll have one further problem though. Let me drop. And that is that you're going to be feeding the outer end of a half wave resonator. You're feeding a 2,000 ohm instead of a 35 ohm. So some re-impedance matching will be required at the base of that radiator. An L network would do it very nicely. And by way of the, can't think of the name of the college in California, there's a program from a college in California where you ask for impedance matching and you tell it what impedance you've got and what frequency you're operating on, and it gives you a whole bunch of solutions. I think you know what I'm talking about. Over to you. And by the way, the fact that the halfway issuing a horizontal, a vertical, or a slant polarization almost doesn't matter. But that would be a approach which would be worth trying, Rich. W2BZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Wait.
Yeah, Berkeley. If you Google Berkeley and impedance matching, and you give it the right pieces of information, frequency, and what you believe the impedance is, it'll give you a whole bunch of solutions, and you choose the one that you like. Over to you, Rich.
Saying the whole screwdriver structure or instrument or coil is what you're calling the base, because this wire is going to be coming out of the top of it rather than, you know, the bottom of it.
That's correct. We're talking about the radiator coming out of the top. If you made it electronically a half wavelength long, you pick up all this benefit where all of a sudden your highly restrictive ground plane radial system becomes extremely simple because you're feeding 2,000 ohms instead of 35 ohms of impedance. So we'll have to do some extra impedance matching. And maybe the right tap of the coil at the right place on the screwdriver will get that for you. But by way of the Berkeley program, you'll find a solution. Over to you, Rich.
Bravo Zulu. I do have a 9-foot grounding rod pounded into the ground, except when I attach that to the bottom of the screwdriver, the SWRs went to infinite, and I don't know why that happened. Could you imagine why that happened? Are you saying I need like a 9-to-1 matching transformer or a 49-to-1?
That's one approach. Another approach would be a simple L network. The right inductor and the right capacitor as an L network, which you'll get from the Berkeley program, will allow you to step 50 ohms up to the 2,000 outer end of a half-wave radiator, half-wave dipole where you're feeding the outer tip. Where you feed a dipole doesn't matter. As long as you've got impedance matching and resonance, you can feed it at the center, halfway from the center to the end or the outer end. The outer end makes it an end-fed ZEP, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
Dick, so we're talking about 66 feet of wire coming out the top.
Yeah, is that a half wave at 40 meters? I think it is. That's if you make it out of one piece of wire. It doesn't have to be one piece of wire. All it has to be is half wave resonant. So you could put a loading coil in there. You could use helical winding, zigzagging of the wire, top hat capacitor. There's all kinds of ways you could shrink the radiator down to a mechanically shorter length. As long as it's electronically a half wave, you get all of this benefit. Over to you, Rich.
Electronically, as opposed to I just went blank. I'll tell you why I went blank, and I don't know if this is, well, it is a way too much of a subject change, but Maxwell's book, and I'll hold off on that a second. But yeah, 66 is a half wave, and I mean physically longer. So what you're saying is the screwdriver maintains its primary function as it did if it had the width that, as I say, I worked the world on in the car. It maintains its exact same function, only now I have an impedance matching problem on my hand. Have I stated that right, Dick?
Yes, you have, Rich. So, if you want to make it physically a half-wave, simple radiator, 66 feet for 40 meters, you could make it a hell of a lot shorter than 66 feet if you put in a loading coil, top hat capacitor, helical winding, zigzag, all kinds of ways you can go. And it doesn't have to be a pure vertical radiator. It could be a slant radiator, if you know what I mean. However, you can physically support that radiator. But if you make it electronically half-wave and find a way of impedance matching the base, and the Berkeley program will help you do that, then all of a sudden your high difficulty of making a ground plane radio system becomes very simple because you're feeding a high impedance, and all you need for your ground plane counterpoise is to be a small impedance compared to your base impedance of the antenna. Small compared to 2,000 ohms, 200 ohms would be more than adequate. The grounding rod would do it. The grounding rod gave you a much higher visual. Let me drop this. Because without the grounding rod, your inadequate ground plane radio system really means you had a great big other resonator for the ground plane. You found some kind of an impedance match with the screwdriver, and that impedance match changed very drastically when you added a real ground with your grounding rod. With the half-wave resonator, you won't have that problem, Rich. Over to you, KQLIW.
Hey, just to throw a little monkey wrench into the question, on my postage-sized little piece of front lawn, I could lay down chicken wire. What would your opinion of that be as a ground plane system?
Until the dimensions of that chicken wire approached a quarter wave in the physical length from the base of the screwdriver, until you approach a quarter wave, which is, what, 35 feet or so, the chicken wire is not going to give you very much benefit. It's just a kind of a capacitor, if you know what I mean. So, to your eye, you think you're making a great big ground plane with the chicken wire. To that radio, until that radio wave, until the dimensions of that chicken wire approach a quarter wavelength at the frequency of operation, it's not going to do very much for you. Over to you, Rich.
Ben, want to comment?
Last question about this is, since I want to play around with a 9 to 1 and a 49 to 1 random length, then it always boggles my mind why they call it random length when it really should be cut to, you know, specific wavelengths. But since I want to play with those type of antennas with the restriction that I have, which is basically going to be the same as the radiator coming out of the screwdriver, I can raise it up over to my car in the parking lot and then back down to the pavement, but that's the only, I can't even get it up a tree. Well, maybe at night I can and then pull it down. But since I want to experiment with those two matching transformers, which one would I go with, number one? And number two, I have a 4-to-1 balance that I used to use with my full wave loops on 80. You heard that right, full wave loops on 80. So I've experienced both ends of the spectrum. But that's what the hobby's about, right, Dick? Whiskey 2, Bravo Zoo.
It's going to take some experimenting with all of those objects you've got, those balance and whatever. Somebody wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Please start off with your call letters, your name, and then your comment.
Whiskey Bravo. W2BZ, this is Whiskey Bravo, 2 Golf X-ray. Mike, the other Rich, of Rich's. Rich, I don't know if you have considered using a vertical dipole or a vertical coaxial dipole. You could do the coaxial dipole with the coax and cut it off at the quarter wave mark with beads. Or you could buy a simple $20 adapter from MSJ and use two screwdriver antennas, one as either side of a dipole vertically oriented, WB2GXM.
Rich, number three, how many feet of hardware are you describing with your dipole approach? And let's find out if Rich number two has got that number of feet of real estate to work with. Rich number three, go ahead.
Todd Long for my physical restrictions here. Again, one-story apartment, no ability to get to the attic, and just a postage stamp lawn size in front. Go ahead.
Rich number three, your approach, how many feet of hardware are we talking about requirement? And that's going to be trouble for them for Rich number two, I think. Rich number three, go ahead.
Allow for your height restriction. It's a pretty compact antenna, WB2GXM.
Please repeat your message, you and I doubled.
With two screwdriver antennas, the original on the top and the second on the bottom, would that fit into your space, WB2GXM?
Boy, I doubt it. Rich number two, go ahead.
Definitely fit into my space. However, this one screwdriver antenna cost me $300, and, you know, they're pretty pricey. I don't know if I want to double that for, well, listen, if that's the only way to do it after I experiment with these other methods, which, you know, I have to get back on the low bands, it's killing me. CW is basically what I do. So, I'll turn it back to Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, two screwdrivers, if you had a whole lot of real estate, is a possible approach. I think you're better off keeping your current screwdriver, make the radiator electronically a half wave, impedance match it with various techniques you've got with 4-to-1, 9-to-1 Balun, or the L network from the Berkeley program. But with a little bit of experimentation, and once you make the radiating system, the resonator, half wavelength electronically, your ground plane radial system requirement becomes an order of magnitude easier. So that's the direction I would experiment with what you've got there, Rich number two. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
K2RIW, Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. On the TechNet. All right. Well, I will. So between the my ground rod, again, 9 foot ground rod, pounded in. I only have about 3 or 4 inches sticking up into the L network or into one of these matching transformers. Then into the ground wire of the screwdriver, and coming out the top is a half wavelength piece of wire. Now, I do want to, you remember, you know, I could lengthen and shorten with the screwdriver motor, you know, the coil, the amount of coil the screwdriver is using. So I could definitely do that. And what you do is you tune the most background noise. And that's where, you know, you have it. And it's pretty accurate as to what it was in the car. I mean, how high or how much out of the tube or not, the coil goes. It's pretty much what I had in the car, because they have markings where it goes. So, all right, I will give that a try. And, Dick, you know, Maxwell's book, I've started reading it, called Reflections, the third edition, and he starts off saying that we're all fools to chase low Vizwars.
Yeah, the actual Vizwar you got is a problem of impedance matching as far as the transmitter is concerned. But high Vizwar of the antenna is not necessarily bad once you can force it into a good impedance match to the transmitter. Just the final stage of the transmitter doesn't like feeding a high Vizwar, particularly if it's solid state. But there are people who think that a high Vizwar antenna is going to be low in efficiency. That's not true. Since the majority of a resonator, whether it be quarter wave, half wave, or whatever, has a signal bouncing back and forth in it, within every radiating antenna we've used, within the antenna itself, there is, by definition, a high standing wave ratio, because only 10% of the signal is radiated on each bounce, and the definition of resonance is you're making all those bounces fall in step with each other. When you do, it gives you a resistive impedance instead of a reactive impedance. But every antenna works with a very high standing wave ratio. Does that make some sense, Rich? Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
K2 Bravo Zulu. Yes, it does. Maxwell, in his book, and I think you've referred to his book many times. I'm not sure if it's Maxwell's book or somebody else's book. But he says, what, the trade-off for, you know, hunting this one-to-one a magical Vizwar is bandwidth that we're giving up. And he said, you know, 2 to 1, 2.5, 2.7, what you lose in decibels is not worth trying to get to this, you know, one-to-one matching. Is that, have I interpreted what he said? He spent his first three chapters of his book talking about it. Chapter one, the title is, Too Low an SWR Can Kill You.
Yes, many an amateur would be horrified by a standing wave ratio of 2-to-1. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in the worst possible combination, only creates a little bit less than half a dB of loss, which is 1/12 of an S unit, if you know what I mean. Without laboratory equipment, you couldn't even confirm it. So in the worst case scenario, you can't get more than half a dB of loss with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Back to you, Rich.
Right, well, that's what he's saying. He's saying people spend their lives trying to get to that, you know, magic number when they really don't have to at all. And he explains in 100 different ways, some of them way over my head, why the trade-off in bandwidth, you know, if you go for a 2-to-1, he explained in some deep space stuff, I think it was deep space stuff that he was doing, they were settling for like 5.5-to-1. They were happy with that. That I don't quite understand, but he said, you know, if he was doing it at the level you were doing it, Dick, you know, I guess you got to listen.
Yeah, if your antenna impedance adjusting circuit, your antenna tuner, has a high enough tuning range, and as long as your feed line between it and the real antenna doesn't have very much loss, then a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio with that antenna tuner can be a very tolerable situation. Over to you, Rich.
But that's exactly what his point was. And it sure was an eye-opener for me, you know, these myths that have been circulating around ham radio dumb for as long as I've been licensed, which got my novice WN2PZZ. I got licensed as a novice in 1962, and until I started really listening to the TechNet about 8-10 months ago, as opposed to popping in and out, you know, I can't tell you how many myths have been that I think a majority of hams still go by, like that 1-to-1, you know, SWR, and how critical the length is. And Dick, you say you could, you know, with the right matching circuits and tuner, you know, you could work with just about any wavelength. However, he did, now that I think of it, he did contradict something you say. Sometimes I've heard you say, let me let it drop. You would actually have to go to the section, and I could probably find it while you were answering other questions. But he was saying the tuner should not be right at the antenna. He said the tuner should be at the rig. I don't remember him. More likely, probably didn't understand why he was saying that. Go ahead.
It's a hell of a lot more convenient to put the tuner at the rig. A remotely fired antenna tuner is a lot more pricey. You have weatherproofing problems. You have maintenance problems. And it's only required if you have a lossy feed line. If your antenna has a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, that means there's going to be a lot of power bouncing back and forth in the feed line, the transmission line. If the transmission line started off with half a dB of loss, and the signal's going to bounce back and forth 10 times in the transmission line, you don't care. If the transmission line has got a lot of loss, then that signal bouncing back and forth is going to be a lot of heating, if you know what I mean, as opposed to radiating. So as long as you've got a low enough loss transmission line, it can be low in loss because it's 1.58 Andrew Heliacs, or because it's short, or because it's open wire line. Any of these things that make the transmission line low in loss. Once your transmission line is low in loss, you can tolerate ridiculously high VISWAS with the antenna tuner in the shack. Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
Understood. His opening in Chapter 2 is this, Dick. In Chapter 1, we saw the obtaining a low, we saw that obtaining a low SWR is relatively unimportant for an efficient transfer of power when line attenuation is low. Four steps to assist in understanding the operation of transmission lines with reflections due to mismatched terminations were presented. Then he goes on to talk about, but that, you know, that's what he's talking about. Relatively unimportant for an efficient transfer of power when the line attenuation is low. He's also, his main point in all this is saying what's misunderstood is reflective power. He said that's where people go awry in their understanding how all of this works. I'll leave it here and because I know there are some people behind me. But if you could comment just on that, Dick, I'd appreciate it. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
End to Rio.
If the antenna has a load on the end of your transmission line is not matched to the transmission line, if it's 50-ohm transmission line, if the antenna doesn't present a 50-ohm resistive load, then there will be some reflected power. A calculated amount of reflected power at a calculatable phase angle of that reflection. Where does that reflected power go? There's an amazing number of amateurs who have got the misinterpretation that the antenna tuner is able to absorb that reflected power, and an amazing number of people think the antenna tuner just simply throws it away. Absolutely not. When the antenna tuner is doing its job correctly, it takes that reflected power, re-reflects it forward in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter at this time, and adds the two together in a voltage manner and sends it back up the line. So the only real problem with a high vis wire antenna is it got a lot of power flowing back and forth in the transmission line with the antenna tuner in the shack. As long as that transmission line is low enough in loss to begin with, that's not a problem. By the way, you guys should now know that the timer on this repeater has been readjusted for something like 3 minutes, so we're not going to be timing out anywhere near as often as we used to. So that's one of the many misinterpretations a lot of amateurs have. Another one I can think of right away is that almost every amateur thinks every UHF connector has got half a dB of loss. Absolutely not. I've actually measured their loss, and it's something like 0.01 dB of loss per UHF connector properly installed. N2EO wants to make a comment. Go ahead, Rich, number one, K2LIW.
Oh, Dick, put me at the end. I want to ask Rich another question. I'm into administrative tools and services, so when I get done, I want to know where I go next. But finish up with Rich first.
Okay, Bravo Zulu. Did any of that make some sense to you, Rich number two? Go ahead.
I can't say, yes, definitely. I think I have the concept you're talking about. It's exactly what Maxwell is talking about. I just don't understand why. And he was doing it from an electrical engineering standpoint, not from a convenience about where the tuner, you know, is more convenient to place. He was saying the way he looks at things, that it's better placed there, whether you can place it at the base of the antenna just as conveniently. And Rich, yeah, I'll answer. I don't know when Dick wants me to, but I'll answer that, you know, your further questions about getting that drive formatted. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, as long as you got your two guys together right now, N2EO, go ahead and ask your further question.
Well, thank you, Dick. Yes, I'm into administrative services and, where's the other one? I'm in there now. What do I look for?
In the disk management screen.
Oh, I was in the list. I look for disk management.
Am I talking to myself? This is Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich, I'm into services. What do I look for on the services?
Rich, can you hear me okay? I answered the question, but nobody came back to me. Are you in the disk management screen?
Oh, I'm in services, and I do copy you.
Services. To the right. I wish I had my computer on. I don't for noise problems, because my computer's cases don't have any sides on them ever. I'm in them so much, but okay. To the right of that, you see a C drive, correct?
Oh, I see a list of things.
Shall we repeat that again?
I see a list of different things.
If you got that, I didn't get that again. Roy, what's he asking? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. You're not supposed to be in component services. You're supposed to be in computer management. If you go to administrative tools, the second thing usually is computer management. You double-click on computer management, you get a window that says computer management. It has a list of things on the left-hand side. At the very bottom is storage, disk management. You click on disk management, and you're there.
Okay, I'm in the wrong spot, boy. Where do I go now?
Where you see your disk drives to the right, a long box to the right.
All right, I'll figure it out later. I don't want to tie up the net. N2EL.
Okay, we'll go over to Rich number 3. WB2, can't read my own writing. GXM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. K2RIW on the TechNet. This is WB2GXM. I have just a quick comment, and I'll go over it. We can go right back to N2EO. But in this latest issue of Nuts and Volts magazine is an impressive article about the Smith chart. And I did not connect rectangular coordinates to the Smith chart until that article pointed it out. It's amazing. And I just thought I should mention that. It's worth reading, WB2GXM.
Very fine, Rich. I am guessing there's also a significant number of sites you can go to on Google or whatever on the internet that'll give you a lot of information about Smith chart and rectangular versus a polar display. What a Smith chart really is it is a polar display of voltage reflection coefficient. The radius of the vector you draw on that screen represents the magnitude of the voltage being reflected from the load, the antenna, and the phase angle is whether or not that strobe comes out at 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and so on. That's telling you phase angle. So, and as you swish in frequency, the dot at the end of that polar vector from the center, all drawn from the center, sweeps out a curve, and that curve is the usual way of displaying a swept frequency response on a Smith chart. But, you can make a rectangular display where the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis is voltage or standing wave ratio or decibels of reflected signal. And but when you switch between rectangular and polar, Smith chart really is polar. It takes some getting used to. But once you get used to a Smith chart and ways of manipulating it, it can give you an awful lot of information as to what's going on with your system. So I think you're saying this Nuts and Volts article is making that a lot clearer for you. I guarantee there are some websites that will also help. GXM, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. It is an amazing article, but the biggest point I've gotten so far from it is that basically what Smith did was to take the vertical component, inductors, positives, capacitives, negatives, and take those infinite points at the top and bottom and bend them all to the right so they meet the infinite resistance point. That was a revelation. WVTGXM.
The article again?
I think he said the latest issue of Nuts and Volts. Is that true, Rich number three?
That is correct, Rich and Dick. It is the latest issue of Nuts and Volts magazine.
The usual way of using a Smith chart, the horizontal axis is resistive component, the vertical axis is the reactive component. If you were taking this round polar display and figure out what's going on, 50 ohms is the dot in the center. To the left of center is pure resistance less than 50 ohms. To the right of that dot, at the 3 o'clock position, you start going toward infinity of resistance. So the resistive component of your impedance is somewhere along that horizontal axis. The reactive component is somewhere along the vertical axis and those curved lines. So for every real impedance at a fixed frequency, there is a dot on that chart that represents that particular frequency. And as you sweep in frequency, that dot is going to move in some kind of a way. And the way that dot moves and the curve it traces, once you get familiar with the Smith chart, is giving you a lot of hidden information as to what's really happening. Mr. GXM, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Anyway, I thought I'd make that comment, and I appreciated the article, and this particular issue of the magazine is also a dynamite thing. Usually, all you get is acronyms from this magazine, and some of them are interesting or not. This particular issue is chock full of good stuff, front cover or back cover. WB2GXM out.
It sounds to me, Rich, like you're a subscriber to Nuts and Volts. If somebody wants to see that latest issue, is there a website they could go to that allows them to see that latest issue? Over to you, Rich.
I'm not sure if Nuts and Volts publishes their content online, but their website is nutsandvolts.com. I'll have to confirm that. WBTXS.
Dick, would you allow me to give Rich number one more shot at this? Because I have a laptop open now, and I could be more precise.
Proceed. I'm out.
Let's hope that that article itself has a way we can, after we go to nutsandvolts.com, if it is, let's hope there's a way we can get to that exact article. Bravo Zulu, go ahead, K2LIW.
Rich number one, we actually have four riches in a QSO now. That's pretty amazing. And in Ohio, they called me Dick also, Dick. They really did. I couldn't get them to call me Rich or Richie. Anyway, Rich, number one, are you in a screen that says computer management under file action view window? What screen, or at the top of the box of the window, what does it say? Does it say computer management?
It says control panel, system and security, administrative tools.
Do you see in the list under that? And boy, if I'm missing what he's saying, please just, I'll be only 30 more seconds. I know. It is time for the science report. Under computer management, if you're in that window, if you look at the bottom, it says disk management right above services and applications. That's on the left of this window. Do you see that?
No, I don't. We'll have to go with this one other night. I don't see disk management, no.
I don't think he's on the computer management window, Rich. I think he's still at administrative tools.
Get this done real quick. Thanks, Dick. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zoom.
Roy, give it a try and see if you can help Rich number one.
Yeah, sure, Dick. Okay, Rich. You're presently, as far as I can figure, administrative tools. There is a long list of programs with name, date modified, type, etc. The second one from the top says computer management. Double click on computer management.
Yes, I just did it.
Okay. Now you'll get a new window. Tell me when you have the window.
Got system tools, storage, and services and applications.
Okay, very good. Now go to the storage portion, and it says disk management, and click on that.
I don't know, I'm clicking on it, nothing has happened. There it goes. Okay. Disk management.
Okay, now you'll see a list of disks, both recognized by Windows and not necessarily recognized by Windows. Below it is a graphic interpretation of those disks. They'll be numbered disk 0, 1, 2, and they'll just keep on going. There'll be one that probably says can't be read or needs to be formatted, or it'll indicate some error trying to figure out what it is because Windows doesn't like HFS file formats, which Apple uses.
Oh, I see. Disk management, snap in virtual disk manager.
Yeah, okay. That should be, it should give you a window. Like I said, there should be two little windows inside that window. One will give you a list of different volumes. You know, Windows C, D, E, whatever, and right below it is a graphic representation. You might have to open the window up wider because it might be blocking the view of the graphic. But it will show you graphics of the different hard drives that it recognizes, whether it can use them in Windows or whether it can't.
Disk 0, do you see something that says Disk 0 on the right-hand graphical part?
I see on the left side, disk 0, disk 1, CD-ROM 0. I see all my drives, I don't see the unrecognized drive. Everyone?
That's the problem I thought we'd run into, and that's going to take a lot more time, all right? Which we could do sometime during the week, all right, Rich? The computer's not recognizing this disk, and to get it recognized, we have to go through some machinations. So, anyway, this is Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu back to net.
Roy, is there anything further you would like to ask add to what Rich is doing? AC2GS, K2IW.
Well, yes. I mean, I'd be interested to know basically if the USB connection is working. He can go to Device Manager and look under USB and see, because it might be has a faulty cable, and that's the major problem of it recognizing. Because even if it's not formatted correctly, it should probably pop up as an unformatted disk. So I don't know exactly why it's not doing anything. The most likely is that his USB connector is set up wrong or damaged or something.
No, not true, because on the devices it shows the drive.
Got to go into other things. Is it a powered drive, or is it just a USB connection without it being externally powered? You know, all that kind of stuff.
No, it doesn't require external power. And it's showing up on the devices, Roy.
Okay, well, then you probably need something more powerful than Windows to get at it. There's also a lot of software. There's the Mac drive, and there's a whole bunch of HFS Plus. There's a whole bunch of software that's designed primarily to read Apple files into Windows. So you might want to find either some shareware that's free, although it's not as simple as the stuff that costs you about $40-$50.
Oh, boy, you misunderstand. It was an Apple. I'm trying to reformat it in Windows 10, Microsoft.
I understand that, Richie. I was just thinking that that might be a way to get around the problem that Windows doesn't really understand that there is a hard drive attached. If you had something that talked HFS, it might make it easier for it to recognize the drive, is what I'm thinking of.
Well, I don't know. I'll give up for now.
Okay. Before we leave, anybody with any final questions or comments with Annette before we go over to the next section? K2LIW listening.
Sam, with a final comment.
GXM, go ahead.
K2RIW in the group, WBTGXM, confirmed. The website is nutsvolts.com. It's all one word and there's no and in there. It's NUTSVOLTS.com. I don't see the story about the Smith chart offhand, but the website is chock full of stuff. It's probably in there somewhere, and if it's not, you'll find something else that you'll enjoy. WBTGXM out.
Bravo Zulu, you want to add anything to that, Rich number two?
A lot of times, what these magazines do is they don't have the current issue or the current article. It's a month behind, so they're not competing with themselves. So it might show up next month. But, boy, I really do want to take a look at Nuts and Bolts. I remember it from years ago. So that's about it, I would think. Thanks, Dick, and thanks, everybody else. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
DC2, SHO, with a comment.
Go ahead, John.
K2IW, KC2, SHO, you know, it's really tough because your 8 o'clock net, your 8 o'clock net starts at 6 o'clock here, so, you know, we're eating dinner. But I didn't hear all of the details on that USB issue, but I wanted to comment. It may be useful for all kinds of troubleshooting. You can buy inline, pretty inexpensive voltage and amperage meters. Klein makes one, and there's a bunch of options for other, Chinese or whatever models of these things. But it's just an inline USB voltage and current meter. And boy, that can tell you a lot about what's going on with the device that you're plugging into your unit. If it's not drawing any current, it's probably dead. If it's drawing current, you can watch it, even a charging item, you can watch it go through the range testing which currents the source can supply. It's very educational as well. So I hope that's useful. Just type USB current monitor, I think, into something like Amazon, and you'll find a bunch of different options. K2RW, KC2SHO, I hope you find that useful.
Yeah, thank you, John. Let's see if we got anybody with any further questions for John. If you want to fill on what he just said, give me your call letters right now. Yeah, I think what you're saying, John, is that over the last few years, there's a zillion objects you can now plug into a USB connector on a computer, and these external boxes will give you antenna analyzer and vector voltmeter and voltmeter and current meter and oscilloscope and spectrum analyzer, I think I already mentioned. Probably even a service monitor. There's a whole lot of devices that are now made USB compatible. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Well, yes, there are those devices, but the point I was trying to make is that there are very simple, inexpensive, inline USB current and voltage monitors that will help you determine, you know, what exactly is going on with the USB device you're plugging in, whether it's a phone or one of those devices you mentioned. Sometimes you might say, boy, it doesn't look like this thing's working. But you plug it in and you see it communicating with the you know, with the computer. You see it first drawing a 200 milliamps, then it goes to half an amp, and then it finally settles down at whatever the system can supply. Some of them give you even more information. I bought maybe 6 or 7 different versions of these things just to play with them and see how they work. Some of them have a load in them, so you can also test the source and see if the source is able to supply the current the device you want to plug in is requiring, and also can the source, being the USB side on the computer, can it